Hello, everybody. This is the Gingerbread Man, and I would like to welcome you to my home. Thank you for being here. I'm very grateful that you showed up, and let's get on with it. So I've had a week of trials and tribulations, as is part of the human experience within all dukkha, within our attachments that we form to this selfdom and this life, and then when we don't see our expectations align with what actually happens, you know, this is where our attachments begin to hurt us, which is what the dukkha is. So I've had to deal with a lot of head trips within myself this week, where I've had a lot of difficulties with my interactions and with how I've been expressing myself. And I've had to do some serious thinking about what my impact is and what I'm doing. And so, as I've said before in the show, you know, my purpose here that I see, that I'm trying to do here, and that I also do throughout my life, I hope, is to push love. I want to be a source of love, a model of love, and of my idea of goodness. And I, when I feel particularly lovely, I want to give that love and to give that what is to me joyful and a good experience. I want to pass that kindness to anybody I come into contact with. And one of the things that has always inspired my love is my love of our species and of our world and what we've done. And I've always been an incredibly curious individual. And because of all of my different idiosyncrasies and curiosities, I have delved in a lot of different directions. And I think it's exciting and it motivates me to want to continue looking for these other directions. And so that's also what I'm trying to do here and in my life, is to inspire people to want to be curious and to build their own spirituality, you know, spiritual reality. You know, I don't think that you have to be given a gospel or a prescription religion. I don't think you have to believe in a God at all or worship in any way. I don't think you have to meditate like I do or do any sort of method that isn't your own method for reaching a space where you can feel like you have a good relationship with your world and your life. This life is like an art project, you know. Every choice we make crafts what we're making here. And we can try to treat our life like a beautiful project, you know, or we can forget about some of those things sometimes. So this is where my head has been developing and possibly becoming too abstract to make any sense. I know that a lot of the things that I am discussing are personal pet ideas that you may not agree with. And there's absolutely no reason that you have to agree with anything that I say. And my email address is quite available in the show notes. It's the gingerbreadmansdialogues@gmail.com. You could find that hyperlink. And so if you have any information that you think could expand my idea, or if you completely disagree with me, you know, I encourage that. And I think it could push me for more growth. And so, like I said, I'm not here to make you agree with me or anybody, but I do wish that you would see how important and how special you are as a anomaly in the space-time continuum that is called life. And you could focus and make your own. Spirituality is such a loaded term. Maybe I need to make up a new one. But your own essence and your own unique attack on life, your own perspective, your own subjective experience, you know, and you can inspire other people to want to go and create their own essence and spark, or however you want to call it. So this week, I would like to go into the subject of what I've been calling letting go. What does that even mean? What does letting go mean? What are we when we are holding on? When we're holding on, we are involved. We have a horse in the race. We have wagered a bet. We're in the boat, our cocks in the fight. Our hands are firmly on the wheel, which is what we're always doing in life. We're consistently steering and making choices, good or bad, mistakes or boons. We're constantly steering. And we have to hold on. Like Ram Dass said, no matter how high you get, you always have to remember your zip code and be able to get home. You have to be able to take care of yourself in this vessel and play all the games that are structured into the society that you have found yourself born in, you know? What I would like to think about is that always what we are meant to be doing? Are we always supposed to be steering? Humans are social creatures. Some people can isolate themselves and seclude themselves from society and make their own sovereign states. And I do believe it happens quite often. But I think for the vast majority of people, we are codependent for our food. We're codependent for our emotions. We feel better when we have human companionship and family and friends. We are hardwired to be social entities. Doesn't that imply that there are situations where authority or hierarchy might come into play because the system of authority makes it easier for things to get done and to meld and amalgamate a group mind, which is how we humans get things done at the scale that we do? Whether it's a kitchen workforce, or scientists investigating a cure or a vaccine or anything that we humans do on this mass scale that has transformed the planet for bad or worse. But we do it because we have this ability to make this Übermind, this Übermensch, this group consciousness. And that comes from a certain letting go of one's own personal control. Not always, you know, and you have different hats that you wear and different roles that you find yourself in. At home with your children, you might be the king or the queen or however you would like to think of yourself. Yet when you go to work, all of a sudden the authority shifts, you know, or if you're in trouble legally and you have to appeal before juries and all that sort, when you don't have any control anymore against your will. Yet, we can relinquish control willfully too, and voluntarily. And this is what happens when we sublimate ourselves to an authority figure, or a boss, or even our own parents, or elders, or any person worthy of that respect, which is part of being human. I'm not saying it's necessarily a bad thing to have hierarchy, and there are situations where you see it turn very foul, such as the way that oppression was grown in the caste system of Indian history and even modern day. Now, I just heard that in 2021, I believe, they illegalized, or supposedly illegalized, you know, shaming of caste systems. Yet people still perpetuate it, just like Jim Crow laws happened in the United States, even though technically it's supposed to be done. There's going to be a cultural clinching, and it's going to take time for that society to adapt, you know, maybe even generations, which is sadly the case sometimes. But in our own little micro worlds and microcosms of reality that we are in, you know, we do have to relinquish control sometimes. We do have to take our hands off the wheel. And I think a lot of anxiety comes from the belief that we shouldn't take our hands off the wheel. Sometimes when we stop driving, we still end up places. We still end up in unexpected places, but sometimes we end up exactly where we needed to be. The difficult thing to come to terms with is that sometimes we shouldn't be driving a particular interaction. In fact, we are the worst person to be commandeering that vehicle in that moment. And within confusion and within self-identification and maybe a grandiose belief that we are the most important person in that situation, which comes from ego and the lack of trust or faith in our loved ones and our partners that we are working with or living next to. Our personal effort can no longer serve a purpose in particular situations. Not all, but some. Our particular aptitude, our skill set. Sometimes we are not supposed to be the guy or the girl. Consider when you've had a fight with somebody, and it might have been a fight over ideas where you were attached to an idea and your fightee was also attached to an idea. And over this battle of wills over ideas, you ended up maiming or saying something hurtful against that person because you forgot that it was a battle of ideas. This happens often when we get frustrated and we find ourselves in aggression where we displace that onto the person, even though the beginning of the fight began over just a misidentification with a simple idea, which we pick ideas up on the ground. It's not who I am. Yet I've hurt people before, and I found myself saying disgusting things against people that I love and I adore and I respect. And then once it is said, it cannot be unsaid, and that does something. And I've found that once it has gotten to a certain point, it doesn't matter how many times that you apologize. It doesn't matter how many gifts you give and how many times you try to recreate the old dynamic that was that old friendship or relationship. But it can't be done because of what has been said. And it also could have been said to you. They could have said things that are hurtful and that you cannot immediately displace and drop down either. You see? In this situation, there's nothing you can do except wait for time. And within time and in the natural place of love to re-enter your heart, what happens is that we close our hearts off to these people that we perceive as separate and we perceive as predators upon us. And this is a defensive maneuver to shut them off and to shut them out of our heart. But all the major religions and mysticisms, I believe one of the crucial things that I've seen in almost every wisdom text that I've ever touched is that you can't shut your heart to anybody. Like Jesus said, you have to love your enemy. Unattached love, that is. Yet, it can also happen, you know, within a sexual relationship where our partner may want to leave us and we sometimes can be blindsided and even confused because from your own perspective, you could have been happy in the relationship and were unaware that your partner was not, which I think is also a common occurrence. And all you want to do is get your partner back, but you can't. You can't. Once something has gone that far and once it's over, it's done. And that's part of life, and there's a cathartic element to it. And when you recover, you can respect that person in a new dynamic and a new light, but you can't go back to the old relationship. Or with addiction, where our desires have become a monkey heckling orders, and we no longer run the ship anymore, and it is purely, it's like we're in the back seat, and this insane monkey is driving our car. You know, that's how I think some people, including myself, especially when I found myself in addiction, that's how I was. I wasn't driving my car anymore. It was a self-destructive just blitzkrieg, burning all the bridges. When you can no longer trust the monkey driving your car, Can you let go and relinquish control to somebody who cares about you to get you to a safer space where you have the sanity to drive again? Do you keep trusting the version of reason that has been captaining your ship up till now? Or do you craft a new captain with better intentions for yourself? I know this is a lot of deep shit, but I think it's important to talk about. I really do. Sometimes our involvement is the problem and we need to step away. It's just a simple truth. Not always, but definitely sometimes. So here's some more examples that I could think of. I'm going to kind of put them in a little section. So this first section is parenting debacles and situations where we need to step away in parenting. You know, there's just multitudes of these battles of wills that we have with our children, especially when you have very stubborn children, which means that they're strong, and then strong will is only going to be good for them in the future. It's just hard right now because their will is against yours and you're fighting. But there's a cyclical nature to these battles of wills that we find, you know, when you're leaving places, going to new places, bedtime, bath time, transitions, when we're switching off of preferred tasks to non-preferred tasks, from TV to clean your room, which is what I'm literally going to do when I'm done recording, is I'm going to go kick my son off of the TV and, you know, we'll see. I'm hoping that he'll be in a good enough mood. I told him he wants to tell some jokes, so he's going to tell some jokes for you at the end of this. But I'm hoping that transition is going to be a will battle. And if I'm not careful, my unwillingness to set down my authority will fuel my son's resentment towards me, which will only make these battles harder in the future. And then with children, any hobby or interest that they have, we parents have to be incredibly careful. You know, we are killjoys, you know. It's like the teenager who likes the music, and then the parent's like, hey, I like that. And then all of a sudden the kid doesn't like the music at all anymore just because the parent likes it. And that's not how it will always be. There will be times when your children will seek you out and want to learn a skill that you have or that you naturally enjoy and that they've seen you enjoy it, so they want some of that. And your kids will seek you out for that. But in those moments, sometimes we're just too busy. And then when the kid wants us to help inspire a hobby for them and a possible connection point between you and the child, you know, if we're too busy, we can shun the kid. And the only time that we want to be involved is when they don't want us to be involved. Often, we as parents only want to help when we want to help, you know? And then in school, we parents, we get ego trips from our own insecurities about institutions and our past experience and our past memories and how we felt in our school experience. We let that color our children's. And if we say we were not very present and very good in school, we might push our children to do better than we did. But this is still flavored by our own insecurities about ourselves. I'm not particularly a good teacher with my son. I feel that I teach and lecture more than I do real talking with people. But most of them are adults. And I feel like I'm a terrible teacher for kids. And I feel like I'm the worst person to hold that hat for my son. And every time that I've tried to step into school and help him with his school, it has made him harder to me because I haven't been approaching him correctly. So with his school, I have passed the hat to the professionals and I have tried to be supporting, which is all I can do. But there was a lot of degrees of letting go involved in that situation because I happened to be very good at school. I never struggled at school. So my expectations for how he should feel about the work are from the beginning flawed, and I can't meet him in the middle ground because I can't see it from his eyes. And that's why he needs a better instructor than me. And that's okay. So when it comes to our friends and even coworkers, you know, fellow helpers out there. You know, this is how I feel. I want to help, but I can't help everyone. And some people don't want the help. And you absolutely can never fix anyone. You don't have the capacity or the tools to fix anyone. Only they can. Only they can make any choices for themselves or how they want to live or how they want to treat people, including you. And you can't change how they treat you. You can't. You can be good and you can cast and broadcast love and you can be as helpful as you can and always be present and available, but you can't fix anybody. Good friendship should be symbiotic. Good relationship is a give and take, a listening and a sharing. But also within that dichotomy of opposites is a presence and a space. Sometimes your friends and your loved ones need space from you and your ideas. As we get closer to our friends, our empathy can cloud our perception of how our friends feel. We begin to trust this reason that is guessing, because that's all we ever do is guess what people are feeling and guess what people are thinking. We're never actually in their head and we're never actually fully empathizing. Our mirror neurons might be firing off, but we can never actually be in that person's head at the moment when they felt that feeling, which is the only time that it was real. But when we become very close, we can get really good at guessing our friend's feelings. But if we trust that guesser too much, you know, within Mira, within illusion, there will always come that moment where we guessed wrong. And the biggest thing they need is your absence, and you need to allow space. And this space, these breaks for friends and lovers, and I wish single parents could get more breaks from their children, because I think that is a healthy effect too. I think if I had less one-on-one time with my son and if I could get away and have a little bit more me time, I think I could be a better parent too. But that, unfortunately, that's not the case. But this space is conclusive, conducive in your life to like letting good meat rest or a cake rise or a souffle or letting wine age or getting good cheese. Personally, within our own little microcosm, we have to let go of our own ideas sometimes. We have to allow space for ourselves. Thinking is exhausting. Planning and fabricating and mechanizing. We trip ourselves up when we overrelate to the narrative we've been feeding ourselves, because we're even telling ourselves a myth of who we are in this world. Whereas I feel that myself is much simpler and it's just observing and getting through and playing this game, but I'm not necessarily the narrative that I'm even playing, if that makes any sense, or the actor in that play. There comes moments when we have to about face. An about face maneuver, which I did in marching band, so I assume it's probably some sort of military stratagem, is you kind of put your heel to heel, you point your other foot behind you, and you switch directions real quick. It's quick, real quick. I'm sure they do it in dancing too, and probably in sports. But sometimes that's what we need to do, is just go the other fucking way. We got to stop hurting ourselves, stop trash talking our world, and we have to just do something completely differently, you know? If you've been living the same exact routine for 10 years, maybe sometimes instead of running Saturday the exact same way you do every Saturday, do it differently. Wake up at a different time. Drive a different way. About face. Some examples of an about face, you know, we might need to completely parent differently or seek help and try a different style, a different reinforcement style, different. We just have to parent differently because maybe we haven't been parenting right. Sometimes we need to change or repair a relationship or a friendship, and sometimes that means applying space temporarily and sometimes permanently. People change, and sometimes we aren't always good for each other. And even if somebody's been the best for you in the past, it doesn't mean they always will. And that doesn't mean you close your heart off to them, but you allow a significant amount of space so that you can continue doing your work, whatever that is. Maybe completely rethinking the direction that you are steering your vehicle right now. Listening to the universe. You might be surprised when she tells you when it's time. And you might have saw it coming and felt a twilight of the soul for a short amount of time. And it wouldn't have been as surprising when that change came. In hindsight, at least. Once the stress evaporates and once you can rationalize and be more comfortable in it. So that's my piece tonight, and we might develop further. I'm going to move on to a little bit of quotations and maybe a little bit of subjective reports for you from my dalliances. So first off, so let's do some Taoism. I've been doing a lot of Chuang Tzu lately, and he's still my favorite. The first one that I want to do, I couldn't find it because I have a book of like 200 of these short parables, and I couldn't remember the title or exactly how it started. So I'm going to do my best rendition for you, and I hope you approve. And it might be a little different because it's coming out of my brain. So you have a competitor, and I think in the parable, it's a knife thrower. And so the competitor is trying to hit a target. And it says, if there's nothing going on and he's just throwing shit at a target, he's going to hit the target bullseye every single time. Say it's for status. All of a sudden, you're throwing for a status, or you have somebody watching you, and so you want to look good. You'll miss about half the time. If you're throwing your knife with a wager in mind and you're trying to win money or personal gain or some sort of property, the parable says that you'll miss almost every single time. So the root of it is that when we're competing or just simply playing life, we should play it non-conditionally and act like nobody's watching and act like we're not playing for any real reason or any real gain, financial or power. I think I did that one good. All right. So this is cutting up an ox. I've probably done this one before, but this one's particularly prescient to my topic for tonight, and I think it wraps up a lot of these ideas. So, cutting up an ox. Prince Wen Hugh's cook was cutting up an ox. Out went a hand, down went a shoulder. He planted a foot, he pressed with a knee. The ox fell apart. With a whisper, the bright cleaver murmured like a gentle wind. Rhythm, timing, like a sacred dance, like the mulberry grove, like ancient harmonies. "Good work," the prince exclaimed. "Your method is faultless." "Method," said the cook, laying aside his cleaver. "What I follow is Tao beyond all methods. When I first began to cut up an oxen, I would see before me the whole ox all in one mass. After 3 years, I no longer saw this mass. I saw the distinctions. But now I see nothing. With the eye, my whole being apprehends. My senses are idle. The spirit is free to work without plan. It follows its own instinct, guided by natural line. By the secret openings, the hidden space my cleaver finds is its own way. I cut through no joint. I chop no bone. A good cook needs a new chopper. Once a year he cuts. A poor cook needs a new one every month, because he hacks. I have used this same cleaver for 19 years. It has cut up 1,000 oxen. Its edge is as keen as if newly sharpened. There are spaces in the joints. The blade is thin and keen. When this thinness finds space, that is all the room you need. It goes like a breeze. Hence, I have this cleaver 19 years as if it is newly sharpened. True, there are sometimes tough joints. I feel them coming. I slow down. I watch closely. I hold back. I barely move the blade, and whoop, the part falls away, landing like a clod of earth. Then I withdraw the blade. I stand still, and I let the joy of the work sink in. I clean the blade, and I put it away. Prince Wan Hui said, "This is it. My cook has shown me how I ought to live my own life." This is so good. I love Chung Tzu. There's a satirical element. He's trying to imbue comedy, and I don't know if it translates completely into my native speaking language of English, but I love it. Some of my favorite Taoism. All right. From the world of Hinduism, I have in front of me Siddhartha by Hermann Hesse, which I always thought was a book about the Buddha, but he did this clever move where he named the main character Siddhartha, but then the Buddha is named Gautama. So Siddhartha is actually a disciple to the Buddha. So it's not an actual story about the Buddha. It's about a devotee being exposed to this potent figure. This is from chapter 2, where Siddhartha has joined a group of samanas, which are ascetics. So they believe that the way to Brahma and the way to self is to destroy all of the desire and all of the attachments to things that we have in our lives. And they do this by fasting and doing incredibly difficult meditations and having all these structured exercises where they spend their whole life self-deprecating in order to get to the thing that is beyond all those illusions. So this is at his beginning of his time with the samanas. Siddhartha sat upright and learned to save his breath, to manage with little breathing, to hold his breath. He learned, while breathing in, to quiet his heartbeat. He learned to lessen his heartbeats until there were few and hardly any more. Instructed by the eldest of the samanas, Siddhartha practiced self-denial and meditation, according to the samana rules. A heron flew over the bamboo wood, and Siddhartha took the heron into his soul and flew over the forest and mountains, became a heron. He ate fishes. He suffered heron hunger. He used heron language, and he died a heron's death. A dead jackal lay on the sandy shore, and Siddhartha's soul slipped into its corpse. He became a dead jackal. He lay on the shore. He swelled. He stank. He decayed. He was dismembered by hyenas, was picked up by vultures. He became a skeleton. Became a dust, mingled with the atmosphere. And Siddhartha's soul returned, died, decayed, turned into dust, experienced the troubled course of the life cycle. He waited with new thirst like a hunter at a chasm while the life cycle ends, where there is an end to causes, where painless eternity begins. He killed his senses. He killed his memory. He slipped out of his self in 1,000 different forms. He was animal, carcass, stone, wood, water, and each time he reawakened. The sun or moon shone. He was again self, swung into the life cycle. He felt thirst. He conquered thirst. Then he felt new thirst. So I want to do some more of that next week. I have one of the dialogues between him and his friend Govinda that I think would be good for it. But so that just shows you a method that a lot of different forms of spirituality and religion have taken. There has been Christian ascetics. There's been forms of asceticism and I even practice asceticism in certain minor regards. I think it's healthy, such as cold water, you know. But he becomes disillusioned with it, as I'll read next week. And then finally, I finished Carl Jung's Red Book, and so I would like to read the last little passage at the end of the chapter, The Magician, before his scrutinies. Yes, this is Carl Jung, Red Book. I came to myself, a giddy and pitiful figure. My eye, I didn't want this fellow as my companion. I found myself with him. I'd prefer a bad woman or a wayward hound, but one's own eye? This horrifies me. An opus is needed that one can squander decades on and do it out of necessity. I must catch up with a piece of the Middle Ages within myself. We've only finished the Middle Ages of others. I must begin early, in that period when the hermits died. Asceticism, Inquisition, torture are all close at hand and impose themselves. The barbarian requires barbaric means of education. My eye? You are a barbarian. I want to live with you. Therefore, I will carry you through an utterly medieval hell until you are capable of making living with you bearable. You should be the vessel in the womb of life. Therefore, I shall purify you. The touchstone is being alone with oneself. This is the way. Doesn't mean we're isolated and completely alone, but if we never focus on being with our own self and making our reality beautiful, like Jung's saying, it could be a medieval hell where we are controlled by our desires, and our ego and our desires are a good servant when we can direct them well, but they're a miserable master and they should never control who we are. Thank you so much for being here. I appreciate your time. I just want you to know that you are an amazing person. You're an amazing gift to this world. You have impact. You will be who you are, no matter how you feel about that. And you affect others. And I'm so grateful that you're here because you gave me this opportunity to put my words and my thoughts out. So thank you for listening. Let's see how Odin's doing this beautiful Saturday morning. Thank you.
Hello, people. It's Asko the Gingerbread Man. My dad, started off, and then my dad wanted me to tell some jokes. I'm a little bit sick, so I'm going to tell you some jokes. So, why did the cat go up the barn?
Up the yard?
Yes.
Why did the cat go up the yard? Why?
Because it wanted to get some cookies.
It wanted cookies? Mm-hmm. Do cats like milk?
Yes.
I think they do like milk. That was funny. Do you have another one?
No.
Can I ask you a couple questions real quick?
Yes.
Come over here so they can hear you. I just had a couple questions. Are there certain situations sometimes where we have to stop doing what we're doing?
Yeah.
Yeah, like daddy has to stop sometimes, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes daddy has to completely just go sit in my room, right?
Mm-hmm.
And gather my thoughts and figure out what I want to say, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever feel like there's situations like that with you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? Do you have any stories?
No.
No? I know it's kind of deep. Well, I just wanted to thank you for being here. So okay. I appreciate you
Bye.
So much.
Bye.
Thank you, guys. Bye.